Welcome once again to Word on the Hills with me, Chris Cameron, my co-host this afternoon, Gwyn Sheltema, and of course our guest, memoirist, short story and travel writer, as well as playwright and blogger, Ronald Mackay. Each week, we visit with a local author or other persons involved with writers and readers. We ask our guests to introduce their work and read for us. We like to get a glimpse into their lives and find out what inspires them and subsequently what prompts them to write about it. And we're delighted to have Ronald Mackay, author of such a great variety of writing, with us today. Welcome, Ron.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you.
Ronald Mackay feels that his life has been, and still remains, a series of periods and experiences somewhat detached from one another. He was born during World War II in his grandmother's rural home in Scotland. In 1946, his family settled in the city of Dundee. Until he attended school, he was bi-dialectal, speaking both broad Scots and standard English. After leaving school, he worked at a variety of temporary jobs that took him throughout Scotland, England, France, and Spain. He's been a market gardener, a forester, a cod fisherman, a farm laborer, a cook, and was employed in the banana plantations in Tenerife. Ron, you started your peripatetic life early, and you wrote your memoir, Fortunate Isle, about the time you spent in Tenerife. So in what ways did your experiences in Tenerife help you come of age?
I began exploring very early. So by the time I left school at 18 and found myself penniless on the island of Tenerife, I was pretty self-reliant. What Tenerife gave me was the opportunity to test myself for a really lengthy period. For a year, I was far from home, among people who spoke Spanish and shared a different culture and a different political regime from my own. That year taught me determination and tolerance. Success reinforced my self-confidence. I learned who I was, what the world was like, and what I was capable of.
If we could talk about your first memoir for a moment, Ron, it was about the next section of your life when you were a young visiting professor in Romania. Why did you want to write about this time in your life?
The choice to start with my life in Romania from 67 to 69 arose, I think, from a subconscious need. I began my Romanian memoir 40 years after having lived in Bucharest. At the time, I was one of only a tiny handful of non-diplomatic Westerners who lived in Ceausescu's Romania. And even after I left, I never met anybody who had lived there at that time. So there was nobody to talk to about it in a meaningful way. I probably just locked that 2 years' experience away in my mind as an oddity. The experience lurked in my subconscious for years without ever having been assimilated. So my Romanian memoir was driven by a desire, a need perhaps, to link the past to the present.
And what incidents in that time affected you most?
That's a difficult question. There were so many. To begin with, the very ethos of Bucharest and the entire country was extraordinary. Nobody trusted anybody. There were informants and secret police everywhere. At Bucharest University, if I spoke to a colleague, they by law had to report the conversation to the Communist Party office. So my colleague simply avoided me. I learned the way to gain the trust of Romanians was by never asking them a personal question. To ask, "What's your name?" was to scare them. They lived in perpetual fear of being denounced and jailed for some fabricated crime. Extreme caution was second nature to Romanians. They examined your every word to determine if you might be a plant by the secret police. One telling experience was when the literary editor of a major British newspaper visited Bucharest in 68. A friend I'd made, Ivan Deneš, a bright and highly educated ethnic Hungarian, begged me to arrange a private meeting with that visiting editor. With difficulty, I managed to do so. I took the editor for a walk. We sat down at a restaurant in the middle of a park at 10 o'clock on a Sunday morning, and I watched Ivan circled the restaurant, observing us from afar. Satisfied, he entered and greeted me as if the meeting was a surprise. He engaged the editor in conversation, but after 15 minutes, he got up and left. Later, I asked Ivan what had gone wrong. He said something I'll never forget. "I do not waste time discussing European literature with a man who has read the great works only in translation." Ivan's contempt for the editor made me realize that we in the West and those locked up behind the Iron Curtain had incompatible views of life. The West saw the Soviet satellites as economically backward, totalitarian states, devoid of everything worthwhile. The East saw the West as too lazy to use their hard-fought freedom to become truly educated and emancipated. I learned later that my good and trusted friend Ivan Denish served as a spy for the secret police. Nothing in Romania in the 60s was what it seemed. When I began writing memoir, I thought Romania would be just one chapter of many, but as I wrote, the memories kept tumbling out, and lo and behold, they turned into an entire volume.
I wanted to bring up a topic that I know you have very strong opinions about, Ron. Perhaps we could talk a little bit about what's now called cultural appropriation, or voice theft, or sticking to your lane, or lived experience. How has your experience impacted every writer's challenge today, writing the other?
All of my work with Aboriginal Canadians has been based on research conducted to professional standards of validity, reliability, and generalizability. Since switching to non-academic writing, I'm hearing a lot about cultural appropriation. We've even seen the reputations of fine writers attacked and destroyed for such so-called crimes. Some social activists would forbid authors to write about anything outside their own lived experience. But the writing tradition we have inherited is one that has evolved over millennia. Wittgenstein and others have pointed out that people use language to play games, games with rules that they make up to suit themselves. This new game of political correctness is alien to our literary inheritance. It fails to understand what a creative writer does. Creative writers should ignore this game that George Orwell in his novel 1984 called New Speak, a game invented to restrict the freedom of thought. I bring to my own writing many of the skills I learned as a naturalistic researcher. But creative writing is not to be confused with professional research or with factual truth. Many post-war Romanians, for example, have told me that my memoir captures the precise atmosphere of the communist dictatorship. Other readers might have been offended. If you're offended, the appropriate thing to do is either to offer a rebuke or, even better, to ignore the offence. It is not appropriate to silence the speaker. I reserve the right to write about Romania as I saw and experienced it and the diverse people I met. I have the same right to write about imaginary experiences in places I've never visited and from the perspective of people very different from myself. This is what writers do. It's what writers have always done. It's what gives us our great literature and our literary traditions. We must not engage with ideologues who would reduce our world to identity politics and simplistic power games.
Ron, can I ask you to read something from your work?
Here we go. From A Scotsman Abroad, my Romanian memoir. Because there was a law that forbade Romanians from having any contact with foreigners, of which there were very few in 1967, I had a lot of time to myself. I developed a delight in using that time to torment any secret police agent whose job was to keep tabs on me. One way I devised was to wait until the moment I thought an agent might be preparing to wind down his day, head home to his wife and family, and leave the next shift to his partner. It was then that I would spring into action and board a streetcar heading to the most distant suburb of Bucharest. As the number of homebound passengers thinned down at every stop, I would sit and scan every face left aboard. I would search for the most unhappy passenger, the one who kept glancing despairingly at his or her watch. I would ride the lurching streetcar to the terminus, alight as if I were going somewhere, and then jump aboard and ride it all the way back again. I must have ruined many a secret agent's evening meal and been the cause of much matrimonial discord. Another way I would torment the secret police was within the walls of my own apartment. Both the British Embassy staff and Romanians alike warned me that every room was bugged. Well, I would quietly open my front door, reach outside and ring my own bell. Then I'd raise my voice and welcome one or more imaginary visitors into my sitting room. Once the imaginary guests were seated, I would engage myself in ridiculously long conversations, altering my voice to give the impression that there were several people present. I would speak in English, French, Spanish, broken Romanian, and even Scots, the first dialect I learned. It amused me to think how these conversations must have kept the Secret Service agents busy, how badly their budget must be suffering. No doubt they could contract translators who spoke English, French, or Spanish, but it greatly amused me to wonder how they might find anyone to translate the Scots.
Thanks, Ron. Now we'll take a short break.